Norma Field will introduce this year's speaker, Dr. Yuki Tanaka of the Hiroshima Peace Institute. But first, I'd like to take just a moment to honor Professor Emeritus Tetsuro Nagita, for whom this lecture series is named. Tetsuo Nagita was born and raised in Hawaii as the son of Japanese immigrants. And as a member of that community, he grew up experiencing considerable hardship during the 1940s. He left Hawaii for the first time to attend Grinnell College, and after receiving his BA in 1958, he went on to Harvard University, where he completed his PhD in history in 1965. He joined the faculty of the U of C in 1969, and until his retirement in 2002, he was an exemplary member of our intellectual community. He was a very productive scholar whose accomplishments include three important monographs, Hatake and the Politics of Compromise, The Intellectual Foundations of Modern Japanese Politics, and Visions of Virtue in Tokugawa Japan. He edited several volumes, and he completed a translation of text by a very important 18th century intellectual, Ogyu Sōlai. Since his retirement, Tetsuo Nagita has continued to be an active scholar. I'm very happy to say that his new book, called Ordinary Economies in Japan, is forthcoming from the University of California Press. It will be published next year. In this book, Professor Nagita explores the economic thought and practice of ordinary citizens in late Tokugawa and early Meiji Japan, and constructs an alternative genealogy of Japanese capitalism, within which cooperative action and a concern for social well-being were viewed as compatible with the profit motive. Tetsuo Nagita was also an extraordinary teacher of graduate students. I'm very proud to say I am a student of his. Together with Harry Haratunian in the 1980s, he forged what came to be known as the Chicago School of Japanese Studies, which emphasized the explicit engagement with contemporary theory as the means to counter the marginalization of Japan, and by extension all of the non-West, within the ghetto, we might say, of area studies. The students he trained now teach at colleges and universities all over the U.S. Tetsuo Nagita also did more than his share of administrative service. Over the years here at the U of C, he served as director of the Center for East Asian Studies, as master of the Social Sciences Collegiate Division, and as chair of the Department of History. Now, in addition to this very considerable record of accomplishments, Tetsuo Nagita also had a talent that I think is pretty rare among academics. He was a phenomenal fundraiser. In the 1970s and 80s, he worked tirelessly to build up the Japanese Studies Endowment. And today, because of his efforts, we are able to support outreach efforts to K-12 schools, to support our graduate students through a variety of grants and fellowship, and to support faculty research and teaching. 3 years ago, my colleagues and I voted to create this lecture series to commemorate Professor Nagita's contributions and accomplishments. Because Tets believed that scholarship must be ethically and politically engaged, we decided that lectures in this series should address an important and timely contemporary issue that has implications for, but also beyond, Japan. In keeping with that intent, we are very pleased this year to welcome Dr. Yuki Tanaka of the Hiroshima Peace Institute. And with that, I'll turn the floor over to my colleague, Norma.
Good afternoon, everybody. I'm Norma Field from East Asian Languages and Civilizations. I'm really very, very happy that Yuki Tanaka is with us today to share what he's doing. I'm also sorry that his topic, as you can see, is more timely than ever. But there you have it. Dr. Tanaka has lived and taught in Australia for about 20 years. He still maintains very strong ties to Australia before he left it in 2000 for different professional venues, most prolonged way at the Hiroshima Peace Institute, as Susan just mentioned. He, after a very interesting abortive career as a student activist, which I learned about at lunch, which gave him a very interesting ethnographic sociological insight into Japan's underworld through his detention experiences. He went on to study Japanese and European economic history, such as British medieval economic history,
as well as a comparative study of Japanese and British industrialization. Has done a lot of work on the history of political and social movements, including anthropology, which included extended field work in the Solomon Islands. And since the mid-1980s, he's concentrated on issues pertaining to Japan's war responsibility for the prolonged, for its prolonged engagement from at least 1931, not just the 1941 to 45 part, and has conducted archival research in Australia and Britain, the US and Japan. And as I read to you some of the titles of his work, I wonder if you won't think what really struck me, which is that how much this engagement with Japanese war responsibility, and particularly most recently with aerial war and with war, therefore, in general in the modern era, has, as it were, organically brought together issues that probably most of us in this room are concerned with, namely national identity, psychology, gender, the environment, popular culture, and minority populations, human rights. All of these things seem to have, as it were, come into his field of concern by beginning with a focus on Japanese war responsibility. So most recently in Japanese, he has authored a book on the history of aerial warfare, which is something he'll also be working on, is working on for English publication. He also has authored a book which I find singularly useful for this topic, Japan's Comfort Women, Sexual Slavery and Prostitution During World War II and the US Occupation, which I recommend to any of you who are interested in this topic. It was a reference title for the 2007 US Congressional Report on Comfort Women. And it is very striking because it is not just about the Japanese military's organization and use of military comfort women, but also of the American use thereof in the occupation. Another earlier title, Hidden Horrors, Japanese War Crimes in World War II, which I understand is a main selection of the Military Book Club and is the second best-selling book among Westview Press's publications. Earlier title still, Rape and War, The Japanese Experience. And then also in Japanese, I'm translating the titles here, Unknown War Crimes, What the Japanese Imperial Forces Did to the Australians. So I think you'll be struck immediately that a long professional location in Australia helped him look at these issues that many of us are familiar and preoccupied with from a different angle, from either a Japan-centered or an American-centered or even a British-centered angle. An article he did for the electronic journal, peer-reviewed journal, Japan Focus, which is a great source I recommend to all of you, japanfocus.org. Japan's Kamikaze Pilots and Contemporary Suicide Bombers, War and Terror 2005, I think, raised their hit level to unprecedented levels. Very, very good piece to read even now. In terms of examining popular culture in this history, Godzilla and the Bravo Shot, Who Created and Killed the Monster, or in 2008, The Songs of Nippon, the Yamato, the battleship Yamato Museum, Inculcation of Japanese Nationalism, which also has a very telling comparison to the role of the Enola Gay in the Smithsonian. Also, I was very intrigued by this kind of pairing. From 1994, medical experiments on POWs in the Southwest Pacific, but also human experiments of gas weapons in Australia. In other words, these are Australians conducting human experiments with poison gas. And we were just talking about how Britain during World War II sent scientists to Australia using Australian soldiers as experimental subjects for jungle warfare. Also, an article I found very useful in looking at yet another part of the implications of our nuclear age, Nuclear Power Plant Gypsies and High-Tech Societies, way in which social demographic factors
play into the labor, the very dangerous labor that goes into maintaining all of our lifestyles here. Very relevant to how nuclear power plants are maintained also in this country, I've since discovered. And then the sustained collegial group collaborative research into archives, producing also psychological studies, as it were, on the subject of, for example, why do people become inhumane in war situations? This kind of work has also led him to publish large reports. One is for the Japanese government, The Battle of Okinawa, New Perspectives for the Understanding of Human Behavior and Psychosocial Problems in Intense Warfare. This is from 2005. And quite a bit earlier, in 1991, you'll see how these interests weave into each other. Special International Tribunal on the Violation of Human Rights of Political Prisoners and Prisoners of War in United States Prisons and Jails. This was submitted to the United Nations Human Rights Council, a multi-authored subject. Now, currently, as a research professor at the Hiroshima Peace Institute, he is he's leading a group project of 9 Japanese historians on the topic of why, historically, looking for historical reasons, why modern Japanese military forces adopted brutal tactics against non-combatants. And this has led to a collaborative work which has just come out. I hope I didn't get the one and only copy from 57th Street Books, called Bombing a 20th Century History, Bombing Civilians a 20th Century History, which looks like one fantastic title for our edification and for teaching. So this is co-authored with Marilyn Young, and Bill Moyers took it up for a very fine review. So I encourage you to look up that link. And then a second team project of, I wanted to say something else, that their lead article in this is by Dr. Tanaka and involved extensive archival research on his part on interwar bombing of Iraq. So talking about the 1920s, really expanding our view of what aerial bombing, how it has evolved and who's participated in it and what the dismal theory rationalizing it is. And then now, that's this book that led to this, sorry. And a lot of archival research on with 7 Japanese scholars analyzing the anti-nuclear and peace movements from its earliest stages, 1945 to 60. And he himself is now doing more research to produce an English monograph that it will be a comprehensive analysis of the history of indiscriminate bombing from World War I to the end of World War II, culminating in Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so, without further ado, let us welcome Dr. Tanaka to give us his lecture on crime and responsibility for indiscriminate bombing and mass killing.
Thank you, Norma. I feel embarrassed, I think, listening to this long list of fabrications. No wonder I'm getting old, I think. since I moved to Hiroshima, my interests have shifted from Japanese war crimes to more wider perspective of the warfare, particularly aerial. Warfare, the bombing in particular. It's not surprising because the Hiroshima is the symbolic part as far as the bombing of civilians is concerned. Anyway, both peace studies and peace movement in Hiroshima have hitherto been based on the city's unique experience as the first theater of nuclear holocaust in the history of mankind. And it is therefore not surprising that the major focus of peace studies there has been on issues closely related to nuclear arms, and that its peace movements have also centered on the abolition of nuclear arms. In this regard, Hiroshima has undoubtedly played an important role so far and his spouse, above all that of the Hibakusha. Hibakusha means the survivors of the nuclear holocaust, carries a certain symbolic weight in world nuclear dialogue. In other words, the atomic bombing of Hiroshima has so far been seen as an extraordinary, unique case of war tragedy, particularly by Hibakusha and their supporters. Now, because of the unprecedented scale of destructive power of the bomb itself, as well as the unimaginable effects of radiation upon human beings and the environment, this uniqueness that the remains in the ideas of the people in Hiroshima is not surprising. Now, for example, the Avon Peace Museum, operated by the Hiroshima City Council, is filled predominantly with exhibits highlighting the victimization of the citizens of Hiroshima as a result of indiscriminate bombing using the atomic bomb. Although there is a brief explanation of the Nanjing massacre in relation to the activities of the Imperial Army dispatched from Hiroshima to China prior to the atomic bombing, the museum invaluably present the atomic bombing of the city as the historically unprecedented and unparalleled victimization of Japanese citizens. Indubitably, the museum conveys a powerful anti-nuclear message. Yet, it is interesting to note that the museum exhibits scarcely anything other than information on the bombing of Hiroshima and even the bombing of Nagasaki and other landmarks of nuclear history are hardly mentioned. You may find that there isn't a single photo of Nagasaki in this museum. Hence, the museum fails to bring light fundamental features common to all victims of atomic bombings, nuclear tests, indiscriminate bombing, and war in general. Due to the rapidly diminishing number of Hibakusha, however, the weathering of Hiroshima experience has become a serious concern for many citizens of Hiroshima in recent years. And in order to confront this problem and to revitalize the Hiroshima spirit of aspiring to eternal peace, it is necessary to re-examine the historical uniqueness of the city in a wider theoretical framework of modern war, in which the universal characteristics of modern warfare, notably including the atomic bombing of Hiroshima, can be critically analyzed. In other words, Hiroshima City still possesses the capability of contributing to the establishment of world peace, I believe, yet that capability must be enlivened by broadening the scope of peace studies and peace movements in the city and adapting them to contemporary issues of war and peace. The bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki typifies two kinds of crime against humanity, I believe, indiscriminate bombing and mass killing of civilians, both of which are common phenomena in modern and contemporary warfare. Now, this passage is from a poem by Hiroshima airborne victim Sadako Kurihara. There was a brilliant white hot flash, building crumbled, fire blazed, smoke swirled all around, wires dangled everywhere, and raising mass of humanity fled to safety. This passage graphically depicts the horror experienced not only by the airborne victims, but by all who have suffered air raid attacks, fire, smoke, flight. Yet the attackers, hundreds of meters in the air above, have little sense of what is happening down below. For the bomber crews, the people on the ground are entirely abstract. They are targets. By contrast, the experience of their victim is of the most terrible concrete reality. The sharp juxtaposition of abstract and concrete is a phenomenon unique to aerial bombing. The premium placed on aerial bombing in modern warfare owes something perhaps to the relative safety of the attackers and the complete inability of the victims. This psychological remoteness of pilots and bombardiers from the reality of the horror on the ground is well described by Charles Lindbergh, who flew the first solo non-stop flight across the Atlantic in 1927. Lindbergh also flew combat missions in Pacific Theater as a consultant for the commander of the US Army Air Forces, General Henley Arnold, during World War II. He said, "You press button and this flies down. 1 second, the bomb hanging harmlessly in your racks, completely under your control. The next, it is hurtling down through the air and nothing in your power can revoke what you have done. How can there be raising mangled bodies? How can this air around you be filled with unseen projectiles? It is like listening to a radio account of battle on the other side of the earth. It is too far away, too separated to hold reality." The origin of indiscriminate aerial bombing can be traced to the application of hot air balloons in warfare in the late 18th century. Initially, air balloons were used simply to locate the size and position of enemy forces, but militarists soon realized the potential for dropping grenade and other harmful object on enemy troops. However, the use of airplane in the early 20th century led to a drastic change in war strategy. One result was the wide expansion of war zones. Another was indiscriminate attack on civilians. It is commonly thought that full-scale indiscriminate bombing, which targets and terrorizes non-combatants, was initiated by the Nazis against the civilians of Guernica in 1937 under the term strategic bombing. The truth is, however, that indiscriminate bombing had already been conducted by both sides of the opposing forces during World War I. Initially, both sides refrained from targeting civilians of all residential areas, but due to the rudimentary nature of their aircraft and aerial bombing techniques, bombs inevitably went astray, killing civilians in their wake. For example, in August 1914, a German plane dropped 5 bombs in an attempt to destroy a railway station in Paris, taking the life of a woman in a street nearby. And by the end of the war, about 500 Parisians had been killed by German aerial bombing. In December 1914, the French army bombed the railway station of Freiburg, but the bombs missed their targets and many civilians were killed. From early 1915, so-called revenge bombing by both sides gradually escalated. Between 1915 and 18, the German dropped 300 tons of bombs on London and other English coastal towns, killing more than 1,400 people and injuring about 3,400, most of whom were civilians. In the final year of the war alone, various cities in Western Germany were bombed 357 times by the Allied forces, who dropped a total of 8,000 bombs, which killed approximately 1,200 people. From May 1917, a German started to use a number of new large twin-engine bomber called the Gotha G1 Buiz to attack England. These were capable of carrying up to 500 kilograms of bombs, and the RAF, Royal Air Forces of Britain, also started producing a similar type of bomber plane called Henri Page in order to reach inland German cities. If the war had continued, the number of civilian victims would have increased dramatically. World War I was a watershed in both the increased quantity and technological improvement of warplanes. And for example, by November 1918, the British forces possessed almost 23,000 planes, having entered the war with only 110 planes. A total of about 100,000 warplanes were produced in France and England during the war. And most importantly, it was at this time that the idea of strategic bombing was conceived and to a certain extent put into a practice. Militarists on both sides argue that the morale effect of aerial bombing on civilians, in other words, popular fear, dissolution, and demoralization leading to a lost working hours, lowered production and perhaps political upheaval would force the enemy nation to surrender quickly. In fact, the theory, which has remained robust in air power circle ever since, was simply a myth that has never been proven. The leading proponent of this theory was Italian strategist Giulio Duhet, author of The Command of the Air, published in 1921, claimed that the quickest way to win the war was to terrorize enemy civilians with intensive aerial bombing, combining three different types of bombs: explosive, incendiaries, and poison gas. In fact, some British generals had entertained similar ideas during the war, although those ideas were never been systematically analyzed. Towards the end of World War I, in April 1918, the British government established the Royal Air Force, historically the first independent air force in the world. Combining its naval air service and army flying corps, the move sought to strengthen the British airborne and bombing capability at a time when London had come under repeated attacks by German airships and bombers. The main task of RAF strategic bombing was to strike military targets as well as densely populated industrial centers in Germany and occupied areas. The bombing of industrial centers aimed not only to destroy military arsenals, but also to break the morale of German workers. For example, Lord Tiverton, a staff officer of the RAF, advocated the use of any method to demoralize German workers, including dropping plane loads of Colorado beetles on farmland in order to devastate potato crops. General Hugh Trenchard, who led the independence forces means the British bomber force, claimed that the morale effect of bombing stands undoubtedly to the material effect in proportion of 20 to 1, and therefore it was necessary to create the greatest morale effect possible. I don't know how you could calculate 21, 20 to 1. What kind of method he used, I don't know. After the war, General Trenchard and other leaders of the RAF claimed that the British bombers bombing had made a great contribution to ending the war by demoralizing German civilians. None of the post-war surveys conducted by the British, French, and the US forces respectively, however, found evidence to support Trenchard's claim. Although Britain won World War I, the war consumed enormous funds and resources, leaving the management of the colonies in disarray. The British Empire faced a serious crisis immediately after the war, encountering popular revolts and violent political demonstrations throughout the colonies and mandated territories. British air power was immediately utilized to suppress such revolts and demonstrations in the territories. But for example, in 1920, an air squadron was sent to Somaliland to suppress a revolt by the local militia. The bombing destroyed not only the fortress of the militiaman, but also private dwellings nearby. Yet it was in Iraq that Britain employed its air forces for the purpose of suppressing local revolts most widely and for the longest period. Full-scale bombing in Iraq by 8 RAF squadron began in October 1922 and continued until 1932, the year that the British mandatory rule of Iraq officially ceased. Various types of bombs, including delayed and incendiary bombs, were dropped in attacks on villages where militia were believed to be hiding. And in some cases, petrol was sprayed over civilian houses in order to intensify the fires ignited by the bombing, incendiary bombing. Tents and other types of Bedouin dwellings and even their cattle became targets, resulting in the deaths and injury of many women and children. British forces justify this indiscriminate bombing by claiming that their operations, quote, proved outstandingly effective, extremely economical, and undoubtedly humane in the long run, unquote, as they could swiftly put down revolts and riots. One of the RAF squadron leaders in Iraq was Arthur Harris, who later headed the RAF Bomber Command during World War II. Based on their experience in Iraq, the RAF leaders concluded that the best way to defeat the enemy was to conduct strategic bombing on civilian dwellings, in particular those of industrial workers. Britain was not, however, the only European power that conducted extensive aerial bombing prior to World War II for the purpose of suppressing anti-colonial resistance in occupied territories. During the Second Italo-Ethiopian War between October 1935 and May 1936, Italian forces airdropped a large number of conventional bombs as well as bombs loaded with mustard gas on enemy troops, villages, crossroads, valleys, river crossing, and other such places. It was a war of aggression that Italian dictator Benito Mussolini conducted out of a desire to colonize Ethiopia as a part of his grand plan to establish a new Italian empire. According to one Italian semi-official report, between the end of December 1935 and the end of March 1936, chemical bombing operations were conducted 132 times, dropping 972 chemical bombs, which amounted to a total of 272 tons. Especially in the Battle of Endeta in mid-February 1936 and the Battle of Maichu at the end of March 1936, Italian forces under the command of General Pietro Badaglia conducted intense aerial bombing using conventional bombs, including firebombs, as well as chemical bombs. In some cases, Red Cross camps and ambulances became targets of such attacks, and Italian also targeted civilians deliberately as part of their attempt to terrorize the local population. In this way, indiscriminate bombing was frequently conducted by certain Western imperial nations outside Europe in 1920s and 30s, and in the Western world, it became tacitly accepted as a most effective strategy with which to terrorize enemy civilians. At the time, however, enemy civilians were people in non-European countries whom Western political and military leaders saw as inferior and uncivilized races. This racist element undoubtedly enabled the British and Italians to feel less hesitant about dropping the bombs. Yet this practice of indiscriminate bombing of uncivilized people clearly trailblazed the advent of strategic bombing among civilized nations during World War II. As in the case of World War I, at the beginning of World War II, both Britain and Germany initially refrained from aerial attacks on civilians. However, in a repeated scenario, both sides deliberately increased their revenge bombings of civilian quarters in major cities following a series of inaccurately targeted bombing. The German forces conducted Operation Blitz for almost 9 months from September 1940, attacking London, Coventry, Birmingham, Manchester, and many other English cities, killing 60,000 civilians and destroying more than 2 million houses. On September 11, 1940, Joseph Goebbels wrote in his diary that this aerial bombing operation would be decisive in forcing the British government to surrender, which never happened. In revenge, the RAF started night raids on industrial cities in rural region in October 1940. However, aerial attacks on German civilians really expanded in February 1942, when Arthur Harris assumed the position of commander of the RAF Bomber Command. Lübeck, a cultural city with no military importance, became the first target of Harris' new strategy called area bombing. Cologne was then attacked by more than 1,000 planes, and other cities such as Essen, Kiel, Stuttgart, Mannheim, Rostock, Berlin were also targeted. In February 1943, Harris pronounced that the morale of the German population in the bombed area had reached an all-time low, and that if the RAF continued bombing, surrender could be expected in the very near future. Night raids continued on many German cities, including Hamburg, where 7,000 tons of bombs were dropped and about 45,000 people were killed. Yet there was no sign of surrender by the Nazi regime. In response, the RAF began to target Berlin, bombing the city 16 times between November 1943 and March 44, while continuing to bomb other German cities. Still, Harris' expectation of Nazi surrender was not fulfilled. On the contrary, the Germans started employing new weapons of indiscriminate killing, V1 and V2 rockets, against England. More than 9,500 V1 rockets were launched, killing about 6,200 people, and about 1,100 V2 rockets reached various parts of England, killing 2,700 and injuring 6,500 people. Claiming again that the Germans were on the verge of the collapse in morale, Harris stepped up aerial attacks. In February 1945, the Bomber Command flew 17,500 sorties and dropped 45,750 tons on German cities. Between February 13 and 15, Dresden was heavily bombed for the first time by the RAF, this time together with the US Army Air Force. And during the 14-hour-long raid, massive quantities of incendiaries burnt large areas of the city that housed no military facility and killed many civilians, and as well as the POWs, some POWs. The estimated victim toll varies between 70,000 and 100,000, the majority being women and children and old people. The US Army Air Force, led by Ira Eaker, joined the bombing campaign in Europe from August 1942, despite repeated RAF requests to join it in low-altitude night bombing. The US Army Air Force adhered to its traditional strategy, so-called precision bombing, in daylight from a high altitude using the northern bomb site. However, in reality, precision bombing was simply an official euphemism, as the bomb regularly fell at least one quarter of a mile from the target. It is not surprising that, therefore, that the US Army Air Forces killed not only German civilians, but also many Allied civilians of German-occupied cities, such as Paris, Nantes, Lille, Lorient, and Amsterdam, as a result of precision bombing. From November 1943, the US bomber started conducting blind bombing by using newly invented radar called an H2X. Blind bombing is, even if you're blind, if you use this new gadget, you can target it precisely and destroy the military target. However, given the technical limitations, the bombing became more random and indiscriminate. Now, you may know that the Professor Howard Zinn was the bombardier during the World War II and involved in the bombing of German cities. And after the war, he went to the German and to see the, how, you know, the effective his colleagues' activity was. And then he found he was devastated to find the he actually killed so many civilians. Now, he says, "We bombed from 30,000 feet, and when a bomb is dropped from that height, there is no way you can identify and hit only military targets. Your bombs will go all over the places within a quarter of a mile, so it was a pretense that we were doing precision bombing. We were killing civilians." I'll show you how accurate the reality of this so-called precision bombing. This was a photo taken by the the US bombers, and they were on a German city and dropping the bomb. And it's, you know, because if you pilot and then the anti-aircraft guns was shooting towards you, and so you're scared, so you try to drop the bomb as quickly as possible and run away. Okay, so that's what he was this plane was doing. But then suddenly another plane came underneath, the Americans, and dropped the bomb. He realized that you can see the two bombs or three bombs already falling down, destroying the tail, another big bomb was going towards this plane. This is the reality of the so-called precision bombing, okay, in World War II. Now, Inca shares the same optimism with Arthur Harris that the British and the US cooperative bombing campaign was destroying German morale. Dissatisfied with the result of precision bombing by the 8th US Bomber Command in Britain, however, General Henry Arnold, the commander of the US Army Air Forces, reorganized the, his forces in Europe and set up the United States Strategic Air Force in December 1943. And Eaker was demoted, and Carl Spatz became the head of the U.S. Strategic Air Force. Excuse me. We observed the steady progress of U.S. strategy from precision bombing to strategic bombing, in other words, indiscriminate bombing, throughout the year 1943 to 45. In the 4 months between September 1 and December 31, 1944, the U.S. Strategic Air Force dropped more than 140,000 tons of bombs on major targets, 60% of the, them in blind bombing. Only 674 tons were used for precision bombing in the strict sense. The percentage of blind bombing increased to 80% of the entire U.S. bombing campaign in Europe between October 1944 and the end of the war in Europe, May 1945. In February 1945, together with the RAF, the U.S. forces conducted Operation Clarion, whereby numerous German towns and villages were bombed from a lower altitude in order to demoralize the enemy nation. It was an operation totally devoid of tactical value. In short, U.S. bombing activities in Europe became no different from area bombing. The fact that the U.S. The Army Air Force leaders abandoned precision bombing in reality but maintained it simply as an official principle is evident in the new counter plan against V-1 and V-2 rockets advocated by General Arnold. That was to fly 500 unmanned, radar-controlled, fully bomb-loaded B-70 bombers and crash them into enemy-held cities. Fortunately, this plan was never put into practice. Nevertheless, by the end of the war, 131 German towns and cities had been bombed, and approximately 600,000 German civilians had been killed by strategic bombing conducted primarily by the British with support from US forces. It was against this background that the U.S. Army Air Force began the bombing campaign of Japan from late 1944. According to Arnold and Curtis LeMay, bombing civilian was essentially in order to break Japanese morale, and this was the quickest way to force them to surrender. At the same time, it was the most efficient method to minimize casualties to their own men. In this sense, Arnold, LeMay, and other U.S. media leaders inherited the idea of strategic bombing that was originally advocated by the RAF leaders in World War I. Now, according to this concept, the killing of enemy civilian is justifiable, no matter how cruel the method. Indeed, it is indispensable to hastening surrender. U.S. leaders, however, in their public pronouncements, would continue to insist that the bombs were directed towards strategic targets. Consider, for example, the President Harry Truman's announcement immediately after the bombing of Hiroshima. He said, quote, "The world will note that the first atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, a military base. That was because we wished in the first attack to avoid, insofar as possible, the killing of civilians," unquote. Truman made this statement immediately following the instant killing of 70,000 to 80,000 civilian residents of Hiroshima. By the end of 1945, 140,000 residents of the city would have died from the bomb. In the end, more than 100 Japanese cities were destroyed by firebombing and two by atomic bombings, causing 1 million casualties, including more than 500,000 deaths, the majority being civilians, particularly women and children. The United States was not, of course, alone indiscriminate bombing in the Pacific War. the Japanese Imperial Navy engaged in the first indiscriminate bombing in the Asia-Pacific region with the January 1932 attack on civilians on Shanghai. Thereafter, Japanese bombers targeted civilians in Nanjing, Wuhan, Chongqing, and other cities. The Chongqing, in particular, was targeted with more than 200 air raids over 3 years from the end of 1938, bringing the total death toll up to 12,000. Here too, the Japanese were not targeting military facilities, but sought to destroy the Kuomintang's center of power and demoralize the civilians who supported this regime. The Japanese were also planning to produce a large bomber like B-29 called the Hugaku in order to reach the west coast of the United States and bomb cities like Los Angeles and San Francisco. Of course, this was never realized. From this brief history of indiscriminate bombing, we can understand that the phrase discriminate bombing against civilians rather than indiscriminate bombing is in fact more appropriate, as the majority of victims of strategic bombing are civilians, in particular women and children. In plain language, strategic bombing of civilian is an act of terrorism. The real question then is there any moral justification in killing tens of thousands of non-combatants in the guise that it will force a Swiss surrender? In assessing specific cases of indiscriminate bombing, we must remember the history of the justification of mass killing of civilians and the practice that we have dated from World War I. And we have shown that in the course of World War II, at different times and for particular strategic reasons, the British, Germans, Japanese, and Americans all engaged in strategic bombing with heavy tolls in civilian lives, following a logic that it would demoralize the enemy and speed up surrender. We must be careful not to get bogged down in an argument such as whether or not the firebombing of Tokyo was strategically justifiable, and whether or not the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki were strategically justifiable. The fundamental question is why the theory justifying mass killing has persisted for so long, even after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. It is important to ask why this strategy was applied during the Korean and Vietnam War, and why a variation of it are still used to some extent to justify the collateral damage of precision bombing in war, such as those in Afghanistan, Kosovo, Iraq, and most recently in Israel's attack on Gaza. At the same time, words should be explored to increase understanding of the fact that killing civilian is a crime against humanity, regardless of the asserted military justification, a crime that should be punished on the basis of the Nuremberg and Geneva principles. It is also important to remember that no war has ever been brought to an end simply by indiscriminate bombing and mass killing of civilians. Indeed, there is abundant evidence that such strategy typically strengthens resistance. The September 11 attack was unquestionably an act of terrorism, as it killed thousands of civilians indiscriminately. This act, perpetrated by an al-Qaeda group, can be seen as a variation on indiscriminate bombing, where civilian planes are used instead of bombers to complete the suicidal mission. One can be certain that al-Qaeda would have used bombers if that had been an option. Whether indiscriminate bombing is carried out by an armed group or by the military forces of a particular nation, it is clearly an act of terrorism from the viewpoint of the civilians who became its target. Why has the criminality of indiscriminate bombing been neglected for so long, despite the fact that so many civilians have been targeted and killed or wounded in every major war or conflict? After the Tokyo War Crime Tribunal, the issue of the indiscriminate bombing of many Chinese cities by Japanese Imperial forces during the war was never raised, despite the repeated wartime condemnation by the US government of Japan's inhumane indiscriminate aerial attacks on Chinese civilians. It seems obvious that the reason for not bringing this matter before the court was America's own conduct against Japanese civilians in the form of a large number of incendiary bombs and two atomic bombs. The fact that the Nazis' indiscriminate bombing of various cities in Europe and England was never a topic of criminal investigation at Nuremberg was probably for the same reason. Major Ben Bruce Blakeney, one of the American members of the Defense Council at the Tokyo War Crime Tribunal, was convinced that the atomic bombing of Japanese citizens was clearly a violation of Hague Convention and the laws and customs of war on land. And he pointed this out clearly in court on March 3rd, 1947. However, the evidence the Defense Council asked the court to adopt was turned down by a majority decision by the judges, and deliberation on this issue was never conducted. Actually, there were a group of American lawyers who were defending the Japanese war criminals at that time. You may think that these Americans, how, you know, they're seriously defending Japanese, but I must say they were very, very professional. Now, the problem was that at that time the Japanese were not very familiar with the international law, and therefore General MacArthur kindly supplied the a group of the American lawyers for the Japanese criminals, and Blakeney was one of them. He actually challenged this court, this victor's justice, by bringing the issue of the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. However, this was totally dismissed by the judges. Now, interestingly, there was one exception at the B-class trial conducted in Yokohama, in which the indiscriminate bombing of Japanese cities by American forces became the major focus in a heated discussion in court. This was at the trial of General Tatsuo Okada, who issued orders to execute several crew members of B-29 bombers who had been captured by the Japanese after being shot down near Nagoya City. Dr. Featherstone, another American lawyer acting as chief defense counsel for General Okada, argued that because the American B-29 crews were engaged in unlawful, indiscriminate bombing, which killed and wounded many Japanese civilians, they were criminals rather than POWs. Featherstone claimed that the execution of those Americans were therefore illegitimate. Although the court found General Okada guilty and he was sentenced to death, it seems that the Featherstone's argument and his evidence presented to the court had considerable influence on the relatively lenient judgment handed down to Okada's subordinate, who had carried out Okada's order to execute. Even American judge and prosecutors sent petitions to General MacArthur requesting that he commute the death sentence to life imprisonment, although the appeal failed to change MacArthur's decision. 2 years ago, or almost 1 year ago, 1.5 years ago, the film Ashita no Yugon, A Wolf for Tomorrow, was produced based upon the documentary book Nagai Tabi, A Long Journey, written by the well-known Japanese author Ooka Shohei. And in 1982, Ooka wrote this book after conducting thorough research on the court proceedings of Okada's case. The film therefore depicts a fairly accurate picture of how the trial was conducted. However, overall, this film presents General Okada as a tragic hero who fought against the injustice of the war crime tribunal conducted by the United States forces, while he bravely defended his subordinate. He took full responsibility for the execution of the American bomber pilots without conducting a proper trial. Yet, I found in the end, because Okada is presented as a hero, his real responsibility for the crime of executing POWs is subtly evaded in the film. So, in a way, it's, you know, Okada became a hero in this film, and the real issue of the war crimes was subtly sort of avoided. This kind of, you know, very subtle way to present these war crime cases is now fashionable in Japan, rather than just showing that how, you know, injustice that the war crime tribunals was, and we are the victims, you know, the real victims of the victor's justice. Instead of doing that, this kind of subtle way to say, you know, well, you know, we committed crimes, but we are the heroes. For example, just the end of last year, NHK also broadcasted a similar sort of a case. This person was the last case of the war crimes. He also executed the B-29 bomb, pilots, and he admitted that he was guilty. And this film was the TV film was broadcasted December 7, the day that the Pearl Harbor attack. I don't know whether NHK intentionally did it or not. I'm not sure about it. But anyway, this is the way that the Japanese now are dealing with the war criminal cases. One of the Japanese members of the Defense Council of the Tokyo War Crimes Tribunal was Shoichi Okamoto, a lawyer who also acted as a member of the Defense Council for General Okada and assisted Featherston. Okamoto's experience with these American lawyers seems to have had considerable influence on his thought on justice regarding the Japanese victims of aerial indiscriminate bombing, including the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Okamoto pursued a legal struggle to bring justice to the air bomb survivors even long after the conclusion of the Tokyo War Crime Tribunals. He died in 1958, but his endeavors eventually led to a judgment by the Japanese Tokyo District Court in 1963, in which it was acknowledged that the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was a crime against the Hague Convention. The judgment of this court case said, quote, "The aerial bombardment with atomic bombs of the cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was an illegal act of hostilities according to the rules of international law. It must be regarded as indiscriminate aerial bombardment of undefended cities, even if it was directed at the military objective only, in as much as it resulted in damage comparable to that caused by indiscriminate bombardment," unquote. However, the court ruled out the claim for individual compensation for damage caused by the atomic bombing, stating that the, quote, the claimant as individual was not entitled to claim damage on the plane of international law, nor was he able, as a result of the doctrine of sovereign immunity, to pursue a claim on the plane of municipal law. In these circumstances, the plaintiffs had no rights to lose as a result of the waiver contained in Article 9A of Treaty of Peace with Japan. In other words, it can be said that the atomic bomb survivors partially won this court case, as it was acknowledged that they were victims of unlawful indiscriminate bombing conducted by the Americans. Unfortunately, however, it seems that the judgment of this court case had very little impact on both the US and Japanese government. It is this background that in July 2006, and again July last year, a group of Japanese peace activists in Hiroshima, July 2007, a group of Japanese peace activists in Hiroshima, including myself, organized the International People's Tribunal on the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The charter of this tribunal was drawn based upon the charter of the Tokyo War Crime Tribunal because we wanted to apply the Tokyo War Crime Tribunal's law to the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And three judges were prominent scholars of international law, and prosecutors and amicus curiae were also professional lawyers. The judgment of the tribunal was handed down in July 2007, and the court presented a guilty verdict for all 15 American political and military leaders, as well as one scientist who were indicted for their shared responsibility in the decision to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki. We selected 15 people I mean, there are many more people who are involved in the actual the decision making and the dropping the atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, but we couldn't indict so many people because we can't spend so much time for going one by one. So we selected the 15 most responsible people. First, the U.S. President Roosevelt, who initiated the Manhattan Project, and then Truman, who made a decision, final decision, to bomb, drop the atomic bomb in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and at that time the Secretary of State, the Barnes, and the Stimson, also the Army Chief of Staff Marshall, and Acting Chief Thomas Handy, Commander of the Army Air Force Arnold, and Carl Spatz. Now, the problem was the when the decision was made, it was verbally told, verbally, that the verbal order was given to Carl Spatz, but Spatz wanted to have a written order because he thought this would be a big issue, and therefore, without written order, he didn't want to do. Okay. Usually, I mean, if B-29 goes to, say, Tokyo or Osaka, bomb, you know, there's no order, except the field orders comes from the Lemay. Okay. But in this case, he thought, Carl Spatz thought, wow, this would be a controversial issue. So he wants to have a written order. So he asked Thomas Handy to get the written order from Marshall. But Marshall and all other important people, Barnes, Stimson, Truman, were at the Potsdam at that time. They were not in Washington, D.C. So Marshall told Handy, you write the order and give it to Carl Spatz, which he did. And this is the form, the order form that I found in the archives, National Archives in the College Park. So we included those people, and also we included the head of the Manhattan Project, Groves, and the Oppenheimer. Now the problem was, the I wanted to indict more scientists, but the lawyer said, no, you can't indict the scientists, even the Groves, because they were not involved in decision making. The developing a weapon is not a crime, no matter how the powerful the weapon is. So, but the reason why they were included in inventory, because they were on the committee of target selection committee. So knowing that a large number of people will be killed instantly, they actually contributed to the selection of the target. Okay, both were on the on this committee. So we included that. All right. Now, anyway, although lacking sanction, the legal sanction, the tribunal verdict is a legal document based on the constitution of the charter, the indictment and judgment as set up by qualified judges and prosecutors. Actually, we have a website of this a tribunal, English, both English and Japanese. So go into the website if you're interested. Just Google search International People's Tribunal on the dropping of atomic bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. You find the website. Now, it must be emphasized that the criminality of a particular act of, defined by law cannot be justified by any non-legal argument to justify the conduct itself. The U.S. government has been persistently arguing that it was necessary to use atomic weapons against Japan in order to end the war, and if the war had continued, millions more people, Japanese, Americans, and Asians, would have died. However, as a matter of fact, the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki was not the decisive factor in ending the war, and its political justification was a myth created by the American government and tacitly endorsed by the Japanese government for self-serving reasons. Indeed, this explanation does not provide an answer to the question, why then the Japanese government had not conceded to the Allied immediately after the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. On August 10, 1945, the day after the bombing of Nagasaki, the cities of Kumamoto, Miyazaki in Kyushu Prefecture, and Sakata in Yamagata Prefecture were bombed. 2 days later, Kurume, Saga, and Matsuyama were targeted, and August 13, Nagano, Matsumoto, Ueda, and Otsuki were bombed. On August 14, in addition to a massive attack on Osaka with 700 heavy one-ton bombs dropped from 150 B-29 bombers, Akita, Takasaki, Kumagaya, Odawara, and Iwakuni became the victims of last U.S. bombing raid of the Asia-Pacific War. In other words, even after the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, every day the bombing continued until Japanese surrendered. Yet, since the official surrender on August 15, 1945, the Japanese government has never lodged official protest with the U.S. government concerning the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, or for that matter, the firebombing of more than 100 Japanese cities and towns. The first and last official protest that the Japanese government made came immediately after the bombing of Nagasaki on August 9, when the Japanese government sent a protest note to the U.S. government under the name of the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Togo Shigenori, condemning the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki as a new crime against human culture. Yet even if such myths that the atomic bombing was unavoidable to end the war were historically accurate, no historical or political justification can legitimate the criminality of mass indiscriminate killing of civilians by the atomic bombing. We must be careful that the criminality of the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki not be blurred by any historical or political debate on the justification for such criminal conduct. In other words, the issue of the criminality must not be evaded by any political or historical assessment of the event. The judgment of the, sorry, this was the, I just showed the bombing. There's the craters, the incredible large number of craters were created by bombings. This is the Iwakuni station. Just show the few months, when is it, the March 1945, a few months before the end of the war, but the Iwakuni was one of the city that the, on August 14, it was bombed. The judgment of the International People's Tribunal clearly stated, quote, "The tribunal notes that the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki caused many civilians to suffer and prolonged the physical and emotional pain and suffering. And therefore, the tribunal concludes, quote, that the illegal action of the defendants, namely the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, constitute crime against humanity. It also claimed that the tribunal notes the existence of the five elements in the definition of war crime. The first requirement involves deliberate killing. The second requirement involves the killing of ordinary citizens and attack on civilians. The third requirement involves deliberate destruction of cities and towns. The fourth requirement involves attack which causes unnecessary and excessive deaths. The fifth requirement involves attacks on unprotected cities. The tribunal notes that the dropping of atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki established all the elements of the definition of war crimes. It also says, quote, in view of this, the tribunal finds that the atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki violated principles of prohibiting the mass murder of civilians, wanton destruction of cities and villages resulting in excessive deaths not justified by the military necessity. Therefore, these acts constitute war crime established in principle 6B of the Nuremberg Principle and Article 5, paragraph B of the Charter of the International Military Tribunal of Far East, unquote. One of the important aims of this tribunal is to establish a true reconciliation between the Americans and the victims of atomic bombs. The The aim of this tribunal is not just condemning Americans. I'm not saying, you know, we have to hate Americans. So this is not the purpose of our tribunal. It was, we aimed reconciliation between the Americans and victims of atomic bombings. Reconciliation, in its true sense, between the victims and assailants of war can only be reached when assailants accept responsibility for crimes they committed and offer sincere apologies and compensation to their victims, and in return, when the victims tolerantly accept those apologies, I think. To accomplish this, it is vital that the assailant use their moral imagination in order to re-examine the psychological pain of the victims and internalize such pains as their own. Without this process of reconciliation, we cannot establish a humane, peaceful, and culturally enriched interrelationship between Japan and the United States. The same can be said regarding Japan's relationship with nations of the Asia-Pacific region that were victimized by Japanese colonialism or wartime military campaigns and atrocities. I sincerely hope that by publicizing the judgment of our tribunal worldwide, we can contribute to the abolition of all types of weapons, including nuclear arms, and to the establishment of more peaceful relationship between various nations. Let me conclude my talk. In any war, it is almost inevitable that the enemy faces are dehumanized. This leads to the dehumanization of the civilian population of the enemy nation as well. Even though those civilians' faces are similar to those of one's own people. If one wishes to prevent the dehumanization of citizens of any country, and thus to reduce acts of violence and terrorism throughout the world, it is most important for each of us to examine such acts from the viewpoint of the victims, I believe. To comprehend the problem of violence as seen in the eyes of the victims means that one must listen to the individual stories of the victims. To re-examine their psychological pain and to internalize such pain as one's own. Sharing memories in the true sense becomes possible only through this process, I believe. The intense desire of American parents to protect their own children against an air raid was vividly expressed in a propaganda poster produced in the US during World War II, using a picture of an innocent girl's face looking apprehensively up at the sky. A photograph of an Iraq father carrying his severely wounded child strikes us by conveying the indescribable sorrow of this man. Both of these images capture the essence of individual stories of victims. By focusing attention on these individual stories, the scope for sharing memories begins to widen as they force one to think about the fundamental question of universal humanity, I believe. So let us work towards for peace, and let me just quote this variation of the proverb. The proverb says, "Si bis pacem, pala bellum." If you seek peace, prepare for war. But I would say, "Si bis pacem, pala pacem." If you seek peace, prepare for peace. Thank you very much.